Good morning. Welcome to the Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee. It is 9 o'clock and I'm calling the meeting to order. A quorum is established. Today we have the Honorable Attorney General Keith Ellison to our committee to present an agency overview and participate in discussion surrounding COVID-related fraud. But first we are going to approve the minutes from April 7th. Vice Chair Anderson, do you approve the minutes?
So moved.
Vice Chair Anderson has moved approval of the minutes from April 7th, which are all in your packets. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from April 7th signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes from April 7th are approved. With
Madam,
that, we would
Madam
like...
Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I just realized that a vice chair wasn't present that day, and so you should pick somebody else to move the minutes.
Oh, you're right.
Sorry, it's one of those little things.
Thank you for catching that, Representative Rarick. So, Representative Rarick, would you like to move the minutes from April 7th?
So move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rarick moves the minutes from April 7th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Minutes from April 7th are approved again. So with that, we'd like to welcome the Honorable Attorney General Keith Ellison to provide an agency overview, and we appreciate your coming to the committee, Attorney General. Please start with your name for the record, and then we look forward to your presentation. Members, the slides for the Attorney General were just passed out a few minutes ago. And yes, Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, in our package, there is appears to be a transcript. Can we, what is the provenance of this? How was this created? And then did anybody check it to look for hallucinations, since it looks like it was generated with AI?
Thank you for asking that, Representative Elkins. Yes, we tried through our staff to have an unofficial transcript made just as we were prepping for the hearing, and it is not an official transcript, and so I just want people to have it in their packets because we may be referring to it, and I wanted everyone to see what we're looking at. But it's completely unofficial. It was our staff work to do the best we could.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the
Yes, thank you. With that, so is all the tech working for you? Okay, we'll just give it a minute. But welcome, Attorney General. If you want to proceed or if you want to wait, it's up to you.
Yeah. Why would we do that? Madam Chair, I did
yes.
hear that you were referring to a transcript.
If I'm sorry. We can make sure you get a copy of it.
A transcript, so.
Yes, it's in the packets, and it was posted, I think. It was posted online, but we can for sure get you a copy. It's just when we heard the audio recording that was released from the defense exhibits, we just did our best as a, on our staff team. It's unofficial. So it's more as a point of reference.
Yeah, and I haven't read it. This is the first I knew that I was going to have to address a transcript. So I'd just like you to know that.
Yeah, that's fine. And it's more addressing the audio, but we just wanted people to have what was a attempt at making a transcript. But it's unofficial, and the and we did post it online to the committee website, and we did reference in our letter of invitation to you that we would be addressing the audio recording.
Madam Chair, I'll just...
Vice Chair, or Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess my one concern I have is just that if it is unofficial, we won't know if there are questions based on it. We won't know if they're based on anything accurate, right? If it's unofficial, we won't know. We won't know that it's correct. How will that work?
Well, we'll get to it when we get to that part of the discussion, but it is unofficial, and we will be relying on the audio the audio that's being played. So the transcript is just sort of, if people want to refer to it. But really what I want to get to, Representative Pinto, is the Attorney General's presentation, which is the bulk of the meeting, where he is going to present about how his office has worked to address the COVID fraud and the work you do with all the state agencies. So please, Mr. Attorney General, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Robbins, and Vice Chair Anderson, DFL Lead Pinto, and members of the committee. As you know, my name is Keith Ellison, and I serve the residents of this state as Attorney General of the State of Minnesota. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm always proud to share the work happening at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office and the ways we're helping our fellow residents in Minnesota. Your letter inviting me here today asked me to provide an overview of the operations of the Office of Attorney General, our responsibility to represent state agencies, our role as the state's chief law enforcement officer, our duty to represent state agencies in civil and criminal matters, and our responsibility to provide oversight of charities and businesses in our state. Allow me a minute to correct the record on one matter, Madam Chair. In Minnesota, the Attorney General is not the chief law enforcement officer. In our model of state government, the Minnesota Attorney General is the state's chief legal officer. It's a subtle but meaningful distinction, as I'll explain in more detail below. With the exception of Medicaid fraud, county attorneys are responsible for charging and prosecuting felonies in our state. Given that, I'd like to start with an overview of what the Attorney General's office does in its role in state and its role in state government. As the state of Minnesota's chief legal officer, the Attorney General has four main responsibilities. First, the AGO represents more than 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions in litigation and in other matters. This work is essential to the effective operation of the state of Minnesota and to protecting the interests and pocketbooks of the people. This includes defending the constitutionality of state law against legal challenges. Second, the AGO plays an important and defined role in criminal prosecution. One way that we do that is by assisting county attorneys when asked. Primary responsibility for felony level prosecution rests with county attorneys, but under section 8.01 of state law, when a county attorney needs help, they can refer the case to the Attorney General's office for prosecution. That's when we step in. Because of the investments that the legislature has made in our office in 2023, we've been able to expand the kinds of cases we can take on for county attorneys. Instead of primarily only homicides, in the last 2 years, we've been also able to take criminal sexual assault, child pornography, drug overdose, and even wage theft cases. In the last 6 years, we've been able to take cases for county attorneys in 39 different counties in every corner of our state, several of which the members of this committee represent. I'm proud to say that in the last 5 years, we've helped 39 counties prosecute more than 100 criminal cases, and I'm proud to say that we have not lost a case yet. We also share original jurisdiction over Medicaid fraud with the federal government, which I will talk more about later in this presentation. Third, the Attorney General serves on several state boards, including the Executive Committee, the State Board of Investment, and the Board of Pardons. Fourth, and finally, the AG is the chief enforcer of the state of Minnesota's consumer protection, antitrust, and charities laws. Of our 430 talented employees, approximately 40% are attorneys. The remainder are legal assistants, investigators, mediators, financial analysts, and support staff, all helping us fulfill our charge as an office. Regarding agency representation, the work we do on behalf of more than 100 agencies, boards, and commissions is as varied as the number of those agencies, boards, and commissions. For example, the Health and Teacher Licensing Division represents Minnesota's health-related licensing boards and litigation and administrative actions related to their licensure and regulatory oversight of healthcare providers and educators. The division also investigates complaints received by the boards alleging licensee misconduct and provides legal advice to the boards. Transportation Division attorneys provide legal advice to Minnesota Department of Transportation, other state agencies, and the National Guard when they're involved in construction projects and provide legal representation to those entities when contractors, subcontractors, or third parties sue the state for construction-related matters. The division also protects taxpayers by filing claims on behalf of MnDOT and other state agencies against entities that make false claims, perform defective work, fail to pay employees legally mandated wages, or otherwise fail to comply with contractual obligations. There are 30 agencies, boards, and commissions that are billed for the services of my office, and over 70 that receive our representation without direct billing through our general fund appropriation. All of the work that the AG does for agencies and all non-agency work is reported publicly and to the committees of jurisdiction every October 15th by statute. I encourage all of you to read this report. We're very proud of the hard and dedicated work it documents for all of our communities and in every corner of the state. Billing rates are set every even-numbered year per Minnesota Statute 8.15. We consult with the Minnesota Management and Budget to determine an hourly billing rate. From there, how to structure these arrangements, also known as partner agency agreements, is up to the AGO and the agency board or commission. These agreements allow the AGO and its clients to re-examine the history of litigation over the last several years and jointly estimate that amount of representation is likely in the upcoming biennium so that all can plan and budget accordingly. Larger agencies like DHS, Public Safety, MnDOT logically need more legal representation. Smaller agencies such as the State Lottery or the Minnesota Racing Commission historically need far fewer hours of our assistance. The current billing rate is $163 per hour for attorneys and $103 per hour for other work like that of paralegals and analysts. Compared with the rates that attorneys charge at private firms, the people of Minnesota are getting the services of a talented pool of lawyers for well below market rate. It's not uncommon for private firms to charge up to $600 per hour and even more. In your letter, you asked about the factors that determine whether we take cases. I want to emphasize that state agency work of our office is mostly determined by the agency board or commission. Our attorneys work with their counterparts in those agencies to determine what work is needed, whether an appeal is in order, or even what the odds of success of a certain course of action might be. If a state gets sued, we have to defend the state. If a board asks us to defend the board in a licensing decision they made, we do that work. In other words, we don't take legal work to agencies, boards, and commissions. They bring it to us. Feeding our future. Another agency we represent is the Minnesota Department of Education, or MDE, the state agency that administered the federal food program expansion during the COVID-19 pandemic. The program that was defrauded by bad actors. As all know, in 2020, COVID-19 caused a massive health crisis, hospitalizing 24,000 Minnesotans, taking over 6,000 lives in our state. This health crisis was accompanied by a massive economic crisis with surges in food insecurity and housing insecurity. A number of extraordinary measures were required to keep people fed, keep people housed, and keep people learning. One of those extraordinary measures was the United States Department of Agriculture program designed to get food to people quickly. The urgency of the need meant that the federal policymakers intentionally reduced red tape and other hurdles that would typically accompany an aid program like this one. Legislation like the Family First Coronavirus Response Act issued a number of waivers so that the meal program operators could have the flexibility they needed to continue to feed children. People were in trouble, and the federal government wanted to get them help fast. Fraudsters, unfortunately, see opportunity in any crisis, like shady folks going door to door offering sham repair services after a bad storm. And the COVID crisis was no different. In November 2020, MDE was the target of a spurious lawsuit from Feeding Our Future, an organization that was later found to be at the center of a scheme to defraud Minnesota's United States Department of Agriculture-funded school nutrition programs. Our office defended our client, MDE, in that lawsuit. This was one of the thousands of cases my office manages at any given time, and we fought hard on behalf of our client. along with her attorney, Amy Bach, founder and executive director of Feeding Our Future, aggressively litigated over MDE's attempts to control what they observed as the expansion of food sites. They made claims of racial discrimination against MDE, leading to sympathetic stories in the media in spring of 2021, and even an order of sanctions being awarded by a district court judge against MDE in June of that year. Throughout 2021, Feeding Our Future wasn't yet a household name. The lawsuit between Feeding Our Future and MDE appeared like a dispute between a community organization seeking reimbursement and an agency doing its due diligence. Feeding Our Future was submitting claims, but to MDE, the paperwork didn't add up. This kind of thing isn't uncommon and is well within the capabilities of our talented team of attorneys to handle in the course of their work. In fact, in April 2025, media interview, Joe Thompson, the federal prosecutor who handled Feeding Our Future case, said, and I quote, "It started out actually as very little," unquote. That's the backdrop for the December of 2021 meeting I attended with some people who represented themselves as small business people from the East African community having some problems with doing business with the state. This was 1 month before the first federal search warrants were issued, 9 months before the first federal indictments. The meeting was recorded without my knowledge. I recently published an op-ed in the Star Tribune to share what happened in that meeting. That document is in front of you, and I'll recap it in brief here. I'll always meet with and listen to my constituents. I meet with people all the time, including people who don't agree with me. In the last few weeks, I've met with constituents in Morris, Minnesota, St. Cloud, Moorhead, Duluth, and all over Minneapolis and St. Paul, including several suburbs. I listen, I ask questions, and I do my best to understand where folks are coming from. That's the job of an elected official, and I take it seriously. At the request of a friend and member of the clergy, I took this December 2021 meeting in good faith with people I didn't know, some of whom turned out to be fraudsters. I did nothing for them and took nothing from them. Some months later, some of them were held accountable for their illegal conduct in the Feeding Our Future case, as well they should have been. But when I entered the room that day, these scammers represented themselves as business people with concerns, and so they engaged their government, which everyone has a right to do. In this meeting, these scammers tried to run the same scheme on me that they used to try and fool the media, the courts, and state agencies. They reiterated their claims of racial discrimination because racial discrimination is real in our society and has no place in our government. I said I'd look into their concerns. But as the tape shows, I made them no promises. They suggested that if I helped them, they'd contribute to my campaign, but I shut that down immediately and rejected it, as the tape also shows. Immediately after the meeting, I went to my staff to get an update on the MDE case and learned of the FBI's involvement. This was before the federal investigation was public, before search warrants, and before any indictments. The issuing of a search warrant is significant because it marks the FBI's readiness to make their investigation public. The warrants represent a finding by a federal court that there is enough probable cause that the people in question have evidence that could help to prove a crime. Once the search warrants were executed in January 2022, again a month after the meeting in question, it became clear to the FBI and then to my office that what Feeding Our Future was up to was far from routine. When that happened, we handled our lane, representing our client and assisting the federal investigation when asked. The FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice worked their lane, investigating, prosecuting criminal fraud of federal dollars. We worked in close cooperation with the federal investigation, making sure that our efforts did not tip off individuals under criminal investigation or otherwise jeopardize the federal case. In September 20 of 2022, 9 months after my meeting, the DOJ issued 49 indictments. That number would rise to 70, and there have been 45 convictions to date. You'll note that both here and in the op-ed, I mentioned the lanes that our office occupies in law enforcement. Here in Minnesota, county attorneys have original jurisdiction for felony-level state criminal prosecution. The Office of Attorney General has authority under state law to participate in state criminal prosecution or appeals, but only when requested by a county attorney or assigned by the governor. So the county attorneys in your home counties are by and large the people who determine whether or not my office is able to work on a criminal case in those counties. This means that under the current state law, there is no statute that would have allowed my office to investigate and criminally prosecute Feeding Our Future. We have, however, in our lane, under our authority as the top enforcer of charities, charitable trusts, and nonprofits in Minnesota, shut down over 20 charities created or revived to perpetuate the Feeding Our Future fraud. In March 2022, as a result of our thorough charities investigation, we filed for the dissolution of Feeding Our Future itself. That case is still pending in Dakota County. I'm going to move on now to address other matters in your letter, but I will happily answer questions on Feeding Our Future after I conclude. Medicaid fraud. In Minnesota, until and unless the legislature sees fit to expand our authority, the Attorney General's office has original jurisdiction to bring a criminal case against someone in only one area of work, Medicaid fraud. I want to spend some time talking about Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and the work they do. Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has existed for 40 years. We're one of 53 in the country. Every state has one, as do DC, Puerto Rico, and the US Virgin Islands. Each one of us is funded by a federal grant from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. That grant covers 75% of our funding and comes with conditions on what we can and cannot do. It requires us to spend 100% of our time investigating and prosecuting Medicaid provider fraud and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults residing in certain settings. With those federal requirements come certain prohibitions too. We're the investigators and prosecutors, but we aren't the administrators of the program. For example, federal regulations require us to be entirely separate from the agency that administers the Medicaid program, which here is the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services, also the entity that refers the Medicaid fraud cases to our office. So we can prosecute it, but we can't turn off payments on the front end or bar a certain provider from enrolling with Medicaid or continuing to receive payments. We also can't investigate or prosecute fraud in obtaining benefits, also known as welfare fraud, or fraud in other public programs. Our investigators and prosecutors are good at what they do in their lane. Over the past 5 years, Minnesota has only spent about $5 million on our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. At the same time, the unit won about $53 million in restitution and recoveries. Let me now talk about charities. You asked me to talk about my office's responsibility to provide oversight of charities and businesses in our state. We have a dedicated charities division housed in the Consumer Protection section of the office. Based upon the legislature's increase in funding for the charities division enforcement efforts, the division hired and onboarded 3 investigators, 1 regulatory analyst, and 6 assistant attorneys general for the division in the past fiscal year. The folks in this division maintain a public registry of charities, charitable trusts, and professional fundraisers that operate in the state. They oversee and regulate charities, charitable trusts, and nonprofits in Minnesota by enforcing charitable solicitation, charitable trusts, and nonprofit laws. The charities division is tasked to protect charitable, not government assets. So, unlike the Medicaid Fraud Unit, which prosecutes people who misuse government funds, the charity division of the AGO oversees charitable organizations and works to ensure that the money that people donate to these organizations is being used for its stated charitable purpose. Since 2019, Charities has resolved over 50 investigations through formal civil tools, including litigation or assurances of discontinuance, which is a settlement of a prior case to a lawsuit, meaning that a assurance of discontinuance is a settlement of the case before we file a lawsuit, which often involve allegations of fraud and self-dealing. So, as an example, in September 2021, the Attorney General's Office secured an assurance of discontinuance with a Minnesota nonprofit known as Pain-Free Patriots. The AGL alleged that Pain-Free Patriots violated Minnesota law when its leadership directed that its charitable grantees seek pain relief only at insider-owned businesses, made grants of more than $2 million to those insider-owned businesses, and turned a blind eye to hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt amassed under the direction of its founder. They agreed to replace the board, determine any potential claims and remedies against the wrongdoers, and conduct governance reviews and implement substantial changes to prevent future abuses. In 2024, the Minnesota Attorney General investigated Eagles Healing Nest, a nonprofit providing veterans and their families with housing and services, after reports that the founder was misusing nonprofit funds. The investigation uncovered evidence that the founder was using nonprofit funds for personal expenses. After the organization formed a new board and hired an experienced nonprofit counsel to improve compliance, the Minnesota Attorney General's Office entered into an assurance of discontinuance with the nonprofit and founder in March 2024, requiring the founder's termination. Continued compliance efforts include reinstating its registration to solicit donations and the founder's repayment of $10,000 to the nonprofit over 3 years. The Charities Division has involuntarily dissolved over 30 fraudulent charities since 2019. The folks in the Charities Division conduct dozens of additional investigations every year into potentially concerning conduct to help detect and correct potential concerns. Their registration team also collects financial filings from tens of thousands of charities, which help prevent fraud by making their operations public and making red flags accessible to our office. Financial impact. As I say, whenever I get a chance, our office sees our work as helping Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. A big part of that work is to take on issues of fraud, abuse, scams, and exploitation, issues that can cause real damage to the state's bottom line and to people's pocketbooks. This part of our story is best told by the numbers. Over the past 6 years, we've protected the state of Minnesota and its residents from harm. In that time, we've contributed $2.1 billion to the bottom line of both the state of Minnesota and Minnesota households. That number far exceeds the legislature's total appropriation to the Minnesota Attorney General's office over the same period. Since 2021, the office has returned over $40 million to the state's general fund in the form of revenue and deposits of undisbursed restitution funds. The office has further contributed significant amounts to dedicated funds like the tobacco or opioid funds. For example, we've reached a total of $565 million in settlements with opioid companies. $183 million of that amount has already been received. The office has also won an additional $81 million for the state's tobacco fund, and a recent judgment of Minnesota may be owed up to $58 million more, plus interest, by successfully litigating against tobacco companies for not paying the state the full amount they agreed to under Minnesota's historic 1999 tobacco settlement, which the Attorney General's office continues to enforce. We also won more than $60 million for the state in our settlement with Juul and Altria over their deceptive marketing of e-cigarettes, which was the largest per capita state settlement in the country with those defendants. The legislature also designated these funds to go directly to tobacco-related prevention efforts. We've returned over $85 million in restitution and debt relief that the office has won for Minnesotans victimized by student loan scams. Our Consumer Action Division has returned $51 million directly to Minnesota's pockets over the last 6 years by helping consumers informally mediate and resolve thousands of complaints with businesses and other organizations, and much more. This group answers over 50,000 calls a year and helps resolve the complaints we receive from people, businesses, and other organizations who contact us for assistance. We've won $9 million in restitution for consumers of CenturyLink and $4 million in restitution and relief for consumers of Comcast for fraudulent and deceptive overbilling, more than $4 million in restitution and relief for tenants who were victims of illegal and uninhabitable living conditions, and $2 million in improperly withheld wages that the office's wage theft division has returned to the pockets of Minnesota workers, and much more. This work is ongoing, whether it means monitoring accurate payment from the tobacco companies for nearly 30 years ago, or current investigations into antitrust deception affecting our state and the nation's farmers, and so much more. In closing, those are the numbers, but behind every single dollar is a real human person and their story. We're driven by those stories. We work hard every day to help give people money back to the state and the people. We work just as hard to protect Minnesotans from scams, to fight Medicaid fraud that victimizes the vulnerable, to make sure your donation dollars are working as they should, to assist in the criminal prosecutions when called upon, and to defend the agencies that do so much more for people of this state. That's the job, and we take it seriously. And let me conclude by saying that I have some staff members who are here to help me answer questions that I may not have all the information. One of them is Kerry Washington, and the other one is Nick Wonka. Kerry runs our charities division. Nick runs our Medicaid fraud division, and they're prepared to answer, help me answer any questions I may not have the answers to. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm prepared for questions.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony and coming before us. I do want to start with a couple questions of my own. So I'm particularly interested in the charities oversight piece, and I appreciate the work you have done on shutting down some of the charities related to Feeding Our Future, but I do have a couple questions about that. So first of all, many of the charities involved, including Feeding Our Future, would be under the jurisdiction of the Attorney General's office. And in you did initiate proceedings to close that down, but there are many ancillary charities that run the sites that have not been addressed. But in May of 2023, I believe, you did reach out. October of 2023, you filed lawsuits to shut down 23. And then in May of 2024, 17 were shut down, which, you know, we appreciate very much that you're minding the store on that. But one of my concerns is that of the 17 that were shut down, none of them were active on your website prior to that. They had all not refiled as charities. So they were operating without having filed their charitable filings in the state. So they were already sort of involuntarily terminated, but then you claim you shut them down. And then also, they all 17 didn't respond to the filing. And so that is the basis on which they were shut down, because they didn't respond. But it's unclear if they're still active, what happened to them. And then of the six that you settled with, it doesn't look, from what I can tell, and it's very difficult to tell, honestly, what happened to them. In some cases, they were allowed to just turn their assets over, I believe, to other nonprofit organizations. So they may be, we don't know, just reconstituted themselves. And that is the case for several of them. So I just wondered if you could speak to those cases. And you put out press releases touting that you shut down 17 nonprofits, but in fact, they were already sort of shut down. And of those six you settled, they also don't, it's hard to see what happened to them. So if you could just address that, I would appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Kerry Washington's here.
Perfect.
She can help me respond to these questions.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to hit these one at a time. So I believe that one of your questions was that many of these...
I'm sorry, could you state your name for the record again?
Yes, sorry, I'm new to this. So Carol Washington, I'm the manager of the Charities Division.
Thank you.
So I believe that one of your questions is many of these charities appeared to be dissolved or shut down already.
Yes.
And one thing that I want to make a clear distinction of is the difference between a charity being inactive, for example, and then it may get automatically dissolved on the Minnesota Secretary of State's website. That is very easy for charities to correct. It also happens all the time, including to legitimate charities. The only thing they have to do is pay $25, file a piece of paperwork, and then they're revived again.
Right.
And in fact, that's what many of these charities did. These were old charities that were revived that hadn't been active for years. And many of these bad actors, what they did is they took these old incorporated zombie entities and reanimated them.
Right.
So the difference between that is, and our work is we went to court to shut them down permanently so that they couldn't be revived. And that's really an important distinction because as you saw here, it's very easy to bring them back to life. So there's a distinction between how they might appear on the Secretary of State's website and whether or not they're actually permanently dissolved. So that's the first question.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. But none of the ones that of the 17 that were shut down were zombie charities that were revived. They were all, in fact, zombie charities when they were shut down. And it's hard to see if now that there's been this settlement, like what in fact is their status? So can you address that? Have their assets been dispersed? If so, to whom? I have not been able to figure that out.
Yeah, so the vast majority of the charities, based upon our investigation, had minimal to no assets because of the fraud. And so I'm not sure what, you know, I'm happy to follow up with specific questions okay. about what do you mean about, you know, what happened next. A court has ordered them to dissolve. They've been terminated. So they've been issued the death penalty for charities.
And so how do you follow up to ensure that that has happened, that they are indeed dissolved and not still operating?
It is reflected on the Secretary of State's website. And the court does a referral to the Secretary of State, provides the paperwork, and the Secretary of State reflects them as dissolved.
Right. I understand that, but that's all just paperwork. Does anyone check to see that they're still not operating?
It's difficult to answer that question. It depends on the circumstances, and I don't necessarily want to get into investigative processes, but a court order is, you know, a significant resolution of the action that we brought.
Okay. Thank you. I'll move on from that, but I would, if you don't mind, I would like to follow up with you about that afterwards in a future conversation. Yes, Mr. Attorney General.
Madam Chair, are you asking if we're tracking the individuals who are associated with those shutdown charities? Is that what you're asking? Because those, if they're shut down, they're shut down.
No, I'm asking if, in fact, they are shut down. Because many charities that are not active on the Secretary of State's website, as you noted, continue to operate. And then they just file a piece of paper, and then they're back having their status. But these that are ordered shut down also appear inactive, but also could continue to operate if no one's checking on them. So I'm just wondering, once a court orders them to be shut down, how do you, in fact, verify they're no longer operating?
Madam Chair, could you identify the organizations that were shut down via court order that you believe are still operating?
I don't know if they're still operating. I'm just wondering if anybody knows.
If they've been, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
If a court has ordered them to be shut down, I think that's pretty much the end of the story for that charity. Now, the individuals, I think it's impossible for anyone to know if they've opened up some other charity under some other name, or perhaps went to some other state or did something else. But that charity, which a court has ordered terminated, that charity's, I would say to you, is either not operating or is operating illegally, but it would be speculating to say that a court-ordered dissolved institution is still operating. And how do we know they're not? Well, they're court-ordered to be shut down. A court order at the end of a judicial proceeding, that's what is like the final word in any case. If there is an entity that's operating that has been shut down by via court order and they're still operating, I'd love to know which institution that is, because that would mean that they violated a court order and could be subjected to contempt.
Right. I appreciate that, Mr. Attorney General. And what I'm questioning is, as the head of charities, like, if a person is convicted of a crime, they go to jail. You can see that happening. If a charity is ordered to be shut down and no one checks to see if, in fact, they've stopped operating, I just don't know how it's verified. So I'm just wondering generally how it's verified. And then in some of the cases, it was actually part of the settlement that their assets were transferred to other nonprofits. So even as part of the settlement, it's not like, oh, well, that entity was shut down, but a new entity, they were required to transfer it to another nonprofit. So it's unclear what that new nonprofit is, who's now involved with that. So I'm just wondering what additional layers of due diligence your office does to follow that thread. If these charities are shut down by the court or in a settlement required to transfer their assets to another charity, how is that then followed up by your office to make sure that they are, in fact, fulfilling their charitable purposes?
Yeah, I can reach that.
Thank you.
I would say this does get into our investigative processes, but we do take the compliance with our settlement agreements and court orders seriously. But it is a sensitive issue to talk about how we might be looking at these organizations right now.
Thank you. And just, I know other people have questions, so I have one more just in this little vein here. So one of the concerns that's been discussed a lot at the legislature this year is once a case has been resolved, how the data is classified. And so in these cases where these charities are shut down and the investigations are over, how is that data classified under Chapter 1365?
It depends on the case. In some situations, especially where there's ongoing monitoring or enforcement mechanisms in the agreement or the court order, it may be active. If there is a complete resolution, and again, it depends on the case. I'm not speaking of any specific case here or otherwise. But if there's a complete resolution, then it would be inactive investigative data.
So would it be publicly available?
Neither active nor inactive investigative data is publicly available.
Which is quite concerning. I think that's one of the reasons we're having trouble finding some of these threads is because it's not accessible. So would you support making closed investigative data about organizations, not individuals, public?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm not going to opine on what the legislature should or shouldn't do. If there is a specific proposal to change the Data Practices Act, we'll respond to that.
Okay.
But at this time, we're going to respect the separation of powers and allow you to decide what the legislation should be, and we'll weigh in on it and if there's ever a specific legislative proposal.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate both of you. Okay, many questions here, so I'm going to turn to Representative Walter Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Attorney General Ellison, and your office staff members for speaking with us today. It's very much appreciated. Appreciate your candor. So just a quick follow-up on what Chair Robbins had to say regarding entities being shut down and then to one degree or another being resurrected in a different form. It may indeed be impossible to know what individuals who were involved with nonprofits that were shut down are currently doing. However, I would certainly hope and presume that as part of the grant management process, when we're in that pre-award phase, we're looking at things like that. So if an organization comes along with a different name, but there are officers involved with that organization or links in terms of where they got their financing or assets that connect to a previous organization that had a problem, that that's something that the state agencies would be looking at. And I see you nodding your head. I appreciate the fact that you're with me on that. I want to go back to this meeting that took place on December 11, 2021. You mentioned here today and in your op-ed that at the time you perceived these as business people with concerns, and that they were using, I forget the adjective you used, but egregious claims of racial discrimination as part of their scam or scheme to try to pull the wool over people's eyes. But when we, in the course of the conversation, we do have a little bit of audio here that I want to play momentarily. It's clear that they're talking about state agencies getting in the way of their ability to conduct business. And that seems to be a reference to grant management. And so, well, let's listen to the audio and then I'll ask my follow-up question.
And so this has my attention. I'm extremely frustrated by it, but we are in the middle of a battle with mm-hmm. the agencies now. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you this, Walls agrees with me that this piddly, stupid stuff running small people out of business is terrible. But it's the problem of like, it's the problem of, you know, it's the classic problem. If he's here and this guy here is giving these businesses a hard time, this guy, these folks somehow say, hey, they're picking on me. And he's like, oh, us? No, we're not. And so it's this back and forth. So now what we got to do is make it clear that this guy has got to stop it. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's the problem. But he knows that there's a lot of unfair discriminatory stuff going on with East African businesses. Mm-hmm. I know it. These department heads like, you know, Julie Herbstead now know that we know it. Mm-hmm. And she says, we're gonna stop doing it. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe it until you tell me mm-hmm. they've stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm. So Attorney General Ellison, it very much seems to me that the abiding concern there is keeping these business people in business. But in point of fact, they were grant recipients who are supposed to be providing services to people in need. And so of the parties that are involved here, you've got the taxpayer, you've got the state agencies who are managing the grants, you've got the grant recipients who would be these business people with concerns, and then you have the people who are supposed to be receiving services. In that chain of relationships, the role that you play, as you've articulated here today, is to represent the state agencies. And of course, your office was in the middle of representing MDE when they were sued by FOF. That happened in November of 2020. This conversation was December of 2021. And so I guess my question is, I'm concerned about the seeming focus and priority on keeping grant recipients in business, as opposed to defending the state agencies and maintaining the integrity of taxpayer funds that are going to these recipients for the purpose of providing services to people. Why was the focus on the East African community business owners keeping their businesses open when those businesses were in fact grant recipients entrusted with a public responsibility?
Madam Chair? Well, let's keep in mind, in December of 2021, the search warrants would not issue for another month. Indictments wouldn't occur for another 9 months. When I'm sitting in that meeting, there is no logical way for me to know what these people have done unless I had some way to know the future. What I'm hearing, and I've heard many times, is that people are trying to start businesses and they're running into problems with state agencies. As you might note, I don't reference the conversation's not even about MDE in the one that you played. What I'm hearing is that we have people who are coming forward with issues, and if they have real issues, I'd like to deal with the, it's not everything is an adversarial relationship. Sometimes if you have a problem and you can talk to the agency and the vendor and resolve the matter, that's a preferable way to do it. But certainly let's ask ourselves one question. What happened after this meeting? I go back to my staff and I'm like, no, we believe those folks are bad actors. And then what happens? Well, within a month, these people are indicted. We're cooperating with the federal authorities to help convict these people. We're cooperating. We're using the authority we have to get them convicted. So in a community meeting where people are representing to me that they have some problems that they'd like to sort out, and I have no facts to support the idea that these are fraudsters, of course I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to go back and I'm going to ask some questions. When I got the questions answered, it was clear to me that these people are not good faith actors. I did nothing for them. There's no claim that I went out and advocated or lobbied for them, because when I did my due diligence, I found that they were not worthy of that. And of course, that's the story. So I guess an answer to your question is, I meet with constituents all the time. I meet with constituents probably, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's multiple times a week since I first got into politics in 2003. Some of them, most of them, overwhelmingly most of them, are good, decent people who just want to be listened to. Some of them are fraudsters. If I have no way of knowing that, they can tell me whatever they want to tell me, but when I go back to do my homework and I find out, then I act accordingly. So I hope that answers your question. Be happy to respond to any follow-ups.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Attorney General Ellison. I find it difficult to believe that you didn't have some suspicion about who these people were and the potential, at least suspicion, of them having some connection to what was going on, simply because your office had already been involved for over a year at that point in the Feeding Our Future lawsuit and defending the state agency of MDE. And, you know, these are folks who are coming claiming racial discrimination by the state agencies, which was the complaint in that very lawsuit. So certainly the idea of state agencies acting in a discriminatory manner towards grant recipients was not a novel concept on December 11th of 2021. And the context of this conversation, and we'll hear more about it later, you're talking about taking the fight to these people in reference to the state agencies. You're saying you're with these folks who you're meeting with, you're going to fight on their behalf. Now, perhaps nothing happened after that, but that was certainly what was portrayed as your intention at the time. And again, my concern here is that rather than the focus being on defending your client, upholding the integrity of taxpayer dollars, ensuring that services are actually being provided to the people who need them, the overriding concerns seem to be grant recipients and keeping people in business. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Attorney General Ellison.
So let's just review the record. So we know that a court had been had issued an order finding that the fraudsters were in the right and that my client was not. That's one thing that had already happened. And remember, that happened, and the conversation happens, and then the search warrant's issued, and then 9 months later, that's when the indictment's issued. So what is the existing record at the time? A court had found that the lies that these fraudsters had been telling amounted to them being improperly denied the money they were seeking, right? So we also...
Sorry, I just want to ask. So you are saying that what the court found in June of 2021 in their contempt order was about the stopping payment? Did I hear you say that correctly?
What I'm saying is that what we see is that, well, here's what I'm saying, and it's very simple, that there was a dispute between vendors and the state. The court found that there was no basis for the client to not have the payments flow forward. That's what I'm saying.
And so, I think that's an error, Mr. Attorney General, with great respect. I believe the order of contempt was because MDE was not making a decision whether to approve applications or not. The contempt judgment had nothing to do with their decision to stop payments. And so I think the record just needs to be accurate on that point.
Well, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Attorney General.
So I'm not really sure right now whether to respond to Representative Hudson or to you. I wonder if we could deal with a question, complete that, and then deal with another question. That way I'm able to, we can keep a clear record.
I think that's a great idea, but I do want to just make sure we're accurate on what the contempt was about. So please proceed in responding to Representative Hudson.
Well, let me just say, Madam Chair, Representative Hudson is suggesting somehow that I should have known that these fraudsters who were lying, not just to me, but to courts, but to the media, to the agency, that I somehow should have known. As I noted, and I said on several occasions, I do not handle every single file personally. I have a staff of 430 people, and at that time, maybe around 380, I'm not sure what the exact number is, that help me do these cases every day. These lawyers and legal workers who work on this stuff, they knew the file very well, but we are one law firm. And so, no, I don't know every single thing happened on every single file. What I do know is that our team is defend state agencies all the time, that they do a good job. And I was well aware that there was a dispute between vendors and the agency. I do know that a court had found against my client. That was what had happened up to that point. I still believed in the position my clients were taking, but I wasn't ignoring the fact that there was at least somebody, including the press, including courts, and including the agency, who had been lied to by these fraudsters. So when I meet with these people on this day, no, I gotta be, I mean, it's just not how it works to believe that I know every single thing that happened on every single file in my office. What I knew then is that there was an ongoing dispute between vendors and the state. What I knew then is that a court had found the client in contempt. What I knew then is that there had been this dispute playing out in the press. But still, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. What did I do for these people? Nothing. I investigated after the conversation. And then what do? We cooperated to help get these people found accountable, as they eventually were. So, no, I have to tell you that in all the meetings that I have with people, some of them have disputes with the state, They may or may not bring them up in the meeting. If they do, I will listen, and then I'll go back to my office and say, what's going on with this? Now, again, in January of 2022, that's when the search warrants issue. That's when the search warrants issue. This conversation that I didn't know was being taped happens in December of 2021. And so let me just again quote the person who did pull the heavy oar on prosecuting these criminals. Let me just find where it says where Mr. Thompson says, in the beginning, this looked small. And so, again, I don't know if that satisfies or not, but the reality is these things often do start out somewhat innocuous, and then when we get into the evidence, it's clear that it's much more than that. I have to listen to people. I do listen to people. But what did I do? I investigated it with my staff. I asked the right questions, and those people were then searched through vis-a-vis search warrants and subsequently indicted. And since that time, many of them were convicted.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Attorney General Ellison. So looking at the picture of this whole quote that we listened to a moment ago, you know, it's one thing to be concerned with the general tone, and you've addressed a lot of just the nature of the fact that you were, in this instance, meeting with constituents. And at the same time, I'm struck by this statement where, and again, we did play it earlier, but it's, and so this has my attention. I'm extremely frustrated by it. But we are in a battle. We are in the middle of a battle with the agencies. So, Attorney General Ellison, can you share for the committee, what do you mean by a battle with the agencies?
Madam Chair.
Sorry, Attorney General Ellison.
Again, we're talking about 3.5 years ago. We're talking about a conversation with constituents who I didn't know who I was talking to. I was just talking to some constituents who had been complaining that they felt that they had not been treated fairly by state agencies. This is not the first time I've heard people say, I have a dispute with an agency. And when this happens, I don't think it's my job to presumptively just ignore what people are telling me. What do? I listen to them, I take notes, and I go back and figure out what's really going on. That's what happened there. I suppose I don't know any elected officials who do talk with constituents, who do try to listen to constituents, who've never been lied to by a constituent, who then go on to find out that what that constituent said at a meeting that sounded highly sympathetic actually isn't true. So, if I may, that's what happens. This is me listening to somebody who's telling me that they have a problem. When I find out what really is going on, when I go back to my office, I find out that that person is not credible. So that's what you're seeing right there. A elected official listening to people, demonstrating some sympathy for the problem that they claim to be having, and then finding out later that this person isn't credible. That's what's going on.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. One follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when I'm looking at this, right, you have been at this point in time, if I'm gathering this correctly, by this point in time, you have been representing MDE for over a year by this point in time. And so when I'm looking at this, in this statement here that goes on and talks about discriminatory stuff, that the, at least through the way that this is written, and the way that your words were here, it was this attempt at saying that discriminatory actions were taking place within agencies. Who in this instance, in your quote here, who are you fighting?
Madam Chair?
Attorney General Ellison.
As you know, the agencies in general are who I'm hearing complaints about. I'm trying to solve problems for people who are telling me that they're having problems. Which agency? I don't know. I mean, I don't mention I don't believe that we even talked about the specific agency. What I'm saying to you, Representative, is that in all the meetings that I would go to and still go to, you'll hear people say, I'm frustrated with how this agency is dealing with me. Sometimes these people may have a legitimate concern about how things are going. Sometimes they lie, and it really is the fault of the person who's telling me that it's not their fault. I can't control what people say to me, but I do try to listen. I do try to demonstrate some sense of, I'm going to try to help you. And sometimes those people are lying. So what we're really talking about here is a clip 3.5 years ago that is before the convictions, before the indictments, before the search warrants, where some people are telling me that they feel they weren't being treated fairly. And I'm saying, yeah, that's too bad. Let's see what's going on there. And then what do? Nothing. I do the opposite of help them. I have my office cooperate to convict them. Now, you said this happened. My office had been working on this for over a year. Yeah, true. And let me tell you, again, we represent over 100 boards, commissions, and agencies. We represent, and all of these group, all of these entities that we represent, my staff does, they give me reports that it's impossible for any individual to know every single thing about everything about every file that every agency does. It's simply not how large organizations work. I have highly competent managers working on this, highly competent deputies working on these things, and they knew, even if I didn't know every single detail. What I knew was that people in a community meeting said, we feel like we're not being treated fairly. I'm like, oh, that's really too bad. And then I go back to figure out what's going on. And what I find out is, oh, those people are the ones who are in the wrong. And then what is our action? Action is to cooperate to help convict these people. So you, not you, Representative, I mean this in the most respectful way. So a individual could say, oh, you should have known all these things. Not really possible, given that the search warrants didn't come out. I mean, when I walked in that room, it's not like I had seen the faces of these people, or I knew their names, or I knew what they were alleged to have done. It just isn't that way. What I knew was some people who I didn't know, who told me they were having a problem. Okay. I did nothing for them, I took nothing from them, and that's it.
Thank you, Attorney General. Representative Elkins.
Turn that on. We're 1 hour and 10 minutes into this meeting, and this is our first opportunity to ask a question. So, Attorney General Ellison, this is a federal crime being investigated by federal authorities. Clearly, the FBI had been working on this case for some time leading up to the issuance of the search warrants, but it sounds like they were playing it really close to the vest. Had they shared any of the information that they had collected in the time leading up to the issuance of their search warrants with you or your staff?
Attorney General Ellison.
Madam Chair, the answer to that question is I was not aware that there was a federal investigation, but my staff probably did know. And the information was held very close to the vest. Here's the reality of cooperating with a federal investigation. They tell you what you need to know to not screw up their investigation. So obviously they didn't, their communication with my staff, which I didn't know when this meeting happened, was, as you conduct your discovery, don't do things that are going to tip them off so that they abscond, so that they wash off motherboards, so that they do things to hide information. But they don't tell us the scope. And by the way, if you believe the quote that Joe Thompson shared in his recent interview, maybe even the feds didn't know the scope of the fraud until the search warrants issued. They knew a lot, but they didn't tell us everything. We certainly didn't know the names of individuals involved. What I knew at that December meeting was that there had been a dispute between vendors and a dispute between the state, a state agency. And at that meeting, I'm not even sure which agency. And their information was held very close to the vest. We cooperated. And the result was that people who were responsible got indicted, got searched, then indicted, then convicted.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Elkins?
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hudson isn't here, but I was going to say sort of back to this question that I think we've been asking as a legislature about this idea of fraudsters sort of taking one form, going to another. We see this in wage theft all the time. There is a lot of work right now that we need to do in the legislature to ensure that we are shutting that down. That's obviously our work in the legislature. Since he's not here, I won't go further on that. This has been a really interesting conversation, but not because, and I think to Attorney General Olson's point, looking back 3.5 years ago before Feeding Our Future was not only a household name, I think most of us didn't know or hadn't heard about it before search warrants, before investigations. At a meeting when I listened to the entire hour where it was clear that the Attorney General wasn't actually sure. You know, I hear complaints about Deed all the time. I hear complaints about DLI. I'm sure my Republican colleagues across the aisle hear about red tape and all sorts of stuff that gets in the way of people being able to get a contract, of people being able to get a grant. That is pretty normal conversations that we have, and certainly as lawmakers, we often have conversations with folks about how we're going to help folks solve their problem. The thing that I actually think that this was helpful for is we're now 3 months into this this conversation about fraud, and it is the first time we've actually seen, you know, the business model of fraud as it operates. Like, we are not talking about, we have not had investigators come in and talk about how they investigate these cases. We have not had investigators come in or in the Medicaid fraud unit or anyone else, prosecutors come in and talk about what it looks like when fraudsters build this together. We have heard in a closer meeting from investigators about how one of the ways that fraudsters actually work is when they go after the whistleblowers, they go after the enforcers, they go after the prosecutors or whoever's doing the investigation. And they have a strategy. And oftentimes that strategy, if it's a closed network, right, might be to go after hard on racism. I have heard it on vets. Why are you coming after questioning vets? To go after folks on religion, whether it's, you know, this is Islamophobic or anti-Semitic. That is actually something we've heard over and over again. A few of us actually heard how that works. This is actually detailing and showing in real form how that works. We also know that these folks went to the mayor's office. They probably went to a set of other elected officials. And as part of their fraud, as part of the business model and the diagramming the fraud, they went after the exact people who were tasked with, and in some cases, and as things move forward, who did the prosecution and investigation. And so I think that's actually what this shows, and it's really helpful to see. It would be really great to talk about the rest of it, to bring in what it looks like to go into and do the forensic accounting. It would be great to go into and see how you network, how these organizations are related. We haven't done any of that. I think we've been saying for now 2 or 3 months, like, let's do that. And so thank you for starting this conversation. I hope that that's where it goes from here. My question for you all in your office in that context is, now, looking back 3.5 years, not what would you have done differently, because I think that's the wrong question, but like looking forward and now understanding that this is actually a piece of how they conduct that fraud, like, as your office is thinking about theft of public funds, What have you learned? What would you recommend to us that we should be looking at in a different way now that we've gone through this experience of Feed Our Future?
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question, Representative. One thing I would certainly suggest is that it's important to be aware that fraudsters tend to figure out what you value and they weaponize it against the entity that they're trying to manipulate. If you say that you really care about, about saving money, then they're going to represent their position as, oh, this is going to save the government a lot of money. If you represent your position as being sensitive to equal opportunity, they're going to say, oh, we're victims of unfairness in some way. If you say that you care about women's empowerment, they're going to say, oh, this is terrible for women. They're going to figure out what you care about, and they're going to somehow say that they're the victims of that. And so I think it is important to keep in mind that when somebody is banging on the table about how the state agency is somehow going after fill in the blank, it's important to really keep in mind that maybe that entity is using that as a shield to not be investigated. What I would say, it is important to not act just on their say-so, to go back to the people who are working the file and say, what's going on? So I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind. I'll also add that it's important to sort of make sure that communication is robust, and that to the degree possible, we try to communicate, and so we get a little bit more heads up. Keep in mind, this is impossible. Here's the one thing about fraudsters. They try to perfect their craft all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they're doing. And if we shut down this area, they're going to pop up in another one. As I said, I happen to know that heaven help us after a massive storm, because people who have had their roof blown off or had some sort of structural damage to their home, there will be somebody knocking on the door. And it's impossible to know, but one of them or two of them or three of them will be somebody who means nobody any good except for themselves. So we have to be hypervigilant when there's sort of a crisis, because some will be good faith actors trying to help, try to provide a service. Others will not be.
Thank you. Quick follow-up. We have many more people with questions here.
I understand we waited an hour, and everybody else has had two questions.
Yes, well, the Attorney General has been very verbose, so it's not my fault.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, we're going to let Representative Greenman have her
Madam
follow-up
Chair,
question.
I'm going to ask a follow-up. Thank you. Because I think that what's important for, if the work of this committee is actually serious and not political, what we should be asking is, what are we learning to ensure that we are protecting public funds and taxpayer dollars so that we can continue to deliver the services that people rely on and need? And so when we think about we've spent a lot of time talking about Feed Our Future, which is an important thing to learn from. It was a pandemic era federal government program. So it doesn't exist the same way now. But we do have billions of dollars that go out the door in Medicaid, and where we are spending government, we are passing through, but we have private vendors, private providers. And it does seem like that's an area where when we talk about, and again, we have not spent as much time talking about it on this committee, because I think that it doesn't align with the political objectives of some of my colleagues. But it feels like that's really the area across the country and here that we should be focusing on. I'm wondering if there are tools that we've learned as we think about our Medicaid fraud unit. I look at this, and I think we asked you to talk about this, but that we spent about $5 million. I think I heard some of this in public safety. We had the Medicaid fraud unit come in. They haven't yet been here. I think we've been asking to be invited, but and that we've won $53 million in restitution. I'm wondering, from the lessons that we've talked about here today, what can we be doing to make sure that our Medicaid fraud and frankly, our consumer fraud, all fraud, but the fraud that's actually the ongoing programs, that we're doing a better job and that the legislature is making sure that we're empowering the enforcement that you're doing, that it's happening at the federal level, and that our agencies are doing to better protect public dollars and the people who rely on these services.
Thank you. Attorney General, I would just note that we did indicate in our letter we do hope to have the Medicaid Fraud Unit back at another time, so I'd encourage you to keep your comments brief, because we will have a full discussion of that at a future date. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I just would like to point out for the benefit of the members here that the head of our Medicaid fraud is present. If people have questions that they like to direct toward Mr. Nick Wonka, who does a phenomenal job, we're very proud of. Well, I will, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative, there's a few things that I hope we don't do in response to fraud, then I'll get to some things that we should do. We should, as public officials, we should not cut off the public. We should continue to meet with people, because it would be sad if, because of some fraudsters, we're like, we won't meet with people anymore because some of them might be fraudsters. I also think it would be unfortunate if we sort of suspect that because of that people are lying to us all the time, although some will be. And we should keep that in mind. But I think we absolutely need to do is just know, what are some of the tip-offs? Weaponizing your sympathies or your values. Staying in tight communication. And then also recognizing this, we feel that Medicaid fraud, we're confident in about our good job that we're doing, because quite honestly, it's a 40-year-old program. We've learned a lot about how to stop fraud over the course of that. One thing we should do and keep in mind is when there's a crisis and we're trying to respond to human need within a crisis, we need to be able to remember that there's going to be somebody who's going to try to take advantage of that. We've got to be able to maintain those safeguards in that circumstance, because the well-worn path of fraudsters, we're probably in decent shape when it comes to those programs that have been around. But the new things that are based on a crisis, that's where you're going to see really a lot of the negative actors try to get involved. So those are some things. Does my colleague have anything to add?
I think we're going to move on. Representative Anderson, thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Attorney General, you know my history. I worked with your two predecessors, and they were both very good attorney generals. I worked with them either as a constitutional officer or as a commissioner. The attorney general's role, as you've said in this, is to represent state agencies. They're the chief legal officer of the state, not law enforcement, the chief legal officer. And you have a fiduciary duty to your clients, and your clients are the citizens of Minnesota, but most of your clients are the state agencies here in the state. And so I sit on the fraud, or the Legislative Audit Commission, too, as you're aware. And since coming back in this role, I have tried to figure out how this could possibly, the Feeding Our Future and all the other fraud, because it isn't just that, how this could have ever happened in the state. And we've been trying to figure it out and get to it. And where did the ball drop, and how did it happen? And there's been a really good, you put a good timeline in here. We've looked at the timeline. But I have some serious questions, because your office knew as early as 2020, your office was involved when Feeding Our Future was sued for the first time. Your office was involved defending MDE, who was essentially pulling payments because they thought that this was fraudulent. So you were very well aware. My understanding is the FBI started their investigation in May of 21. I don't know what point you yourself personally were aware that the FBI was investigating, but certainly your staff was as early as May of 21. And I've got to believe that you were aware, unless your office is poorly run, which I don't believe. I think it's well run, probably. I'm sure that you knew at some point after that that the FBI was in. But I have a clip, and I want to play this, because this is important.
These are children.
So basically what we're talking about here, General Ellison, is we have systemic patterns of abuse, waste, and fraud from the departments claiming the same from minority business owners. And we've taken it far too long, but we are not willing to operate under that paradigm anymore.
Okay.
And we are jumping into the fight with some serious money, serious organizing, and we need you in this fight with us. And I know you're going to get hit hard, but we are going to commit to backing you.
How am I going to get hit hard?
Politically.
How? From who? Where?
Opponents, establishment. They're hitting you hard all the time.
Yes, so nothing's new.
So what we're saying is...
I'm going to get a new hit for that.
So what we're saying is... We want to invest in leaders.
I showed you the letters they threatened to kill me last week. Last week.
Yeah.
Last week. And Ilhan gets more, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
we're saying is.
Hey, like she gets every day.
We need to cultivate our leaders to fight for these communities, and not just that, to grow and develop and bring a new generation of leaders into office. And we are ready and willing to back those efforts all the way. But we need a true and steadfast partner to fight for basic justice. And that is your MO.
Well, brother, let me just tell you this.
Yeah.
Of course I'm here to help. I mean, but let me be clear. I'm not here because I think it's going to help my re-election.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give a. I don't care about no re-election.
Mm-hmm.
I voluntarily threw my congressional career away.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I don't want to do it anymore. It's boring to me. So to do this, to do what I'm doing now. So, of course, I didn't leave that job to do nothing in this job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is this? Am I going to get more hits than I got by prosecuting a police officer and giving them life in prison?
Mm-mm.
Right. So we're gonna So let's just go fight these people.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is figuring out exactly how to put a stop to it. Right.
Can you play the? I have one other, and they're related because they're all on the same. Thank you.
These are children that need food, and it's very serious. So instead of being able to do more than one thing as a huge department with tons of money, it's, we need to pause while we figure something out.
But as they're pausing, they're running people out of business.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah,
that's the intention.
That's the point. You're a vendor, you put $200,000 into this, you sold this food to this person, and all of a sudden you're making more money. What happens?
30, yes. April
30. You're done? You're done. And you still got people who you all want.
Yes. And people are, and then you decide, okay, let me pause until I get reimbursed. And people are still coming to your door saying, hey, you just gave us food last week. We were counting on you.
Yeah.
You don't have food. Nobody
there are
food.
Vendors
wait, now,
who provided services in the beginning of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So April 30th came pause.
That have not received payment.
Then we're going to pray. Allah did them restaurant.
Could you, let me send you, him your, give you an email, okay?
Okay.
Send it to this email. Send it to my government email. Keith, whenever you're ready.
Keith?
K-E-I-T-H dot Ellison, E-L-L-I-S-O-N, at A-G dot state dot...
A-G dot state dot M-N.
Dot U-S. And just send me the names of all these folks who are just hung up and like hanging on by a thread and barely going to, and probably ain't going to survive unless they get their money soon. That I can take that list and start saying, and I can call Joey Harpstead, the person over at education, and say, what is going on? Why am I getting these complaints?
Mm-hmm.
And start, and I'll call them in my office and demand some explanations.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I'm one of them, those guys you're talking about. April 30th, I got shut down, and I got they put me on bows.
You say April?
April 30th.
Yeah.
You mean throughout the whole summer and the fall?
Yep, and I
so
have...
You ain't
have,
got no money since then?
No, yeah. I have like 10 pilots sitting up there at Safari. Serial pilots, they expire. It's about like $80,000 worth.
So the lawsuit actually initiated from the restaurant, especially Safari. Safari was the largest. And obviously being the largest restaurant, they had that big old wedding hall. So that was clearly the person that is suing your client, the person that sued the Department of Ed. He's also, in the end, which you didn't know, he's been convicted of 21 felonies. But he was, in this conversation, you know, said that he is the owner of Safari and that he was one of the lead plaintiffs on the lawsuit against your client. So you said earlier in this conversation that you didn't know who you were talking about, but they, in this conversation, told you who you were talking to. You were talking to the person suing that had sued the state of Minnesota and sued your client. And you have a duty, a fiduciary duty, to protect your client, who is MDE. And you knew, they said in April, that they were shut down in April. And you knew in April, that's when the Department of Ed shut down the fraudsters. They stopped payment on people. And in his case, it didn't restart in the summer. Still in December, he wasn't getting paid. So it was clear that he was one of the bad guys at the time.
Please get to your question.
Well, yeah, we're running out of time. Sorry. But why do you say now that you didn't know who he was when he clearly told you who he was? And why are you offering help to these people to work against your client, who's the agency?
Mr. Attorney General.
Well, here are the facts, Madam Chair. What's the help that these people got? No help. They got the FBI and the Attorney General's office and the Department of Justice got help to actually pursue accountability with these people. That's the help that they got. We're talking about me listening to people representing themselves as some sort of victims in a meeting. The actual help was the help that my office lended to the people who convicted these people. So that's the help that they got. No help at all. Actually, they got convicted. What you're asking is, why did I sit in a meeting and listen to people? Well, because I don't regard listening to a constituent as a damaging thing to do, because I'm certainly going to go back and ask my staff what's going on here. And it's actually what I did, and these people have been held accountable. Now, clearly these people, the tape that you played does show a few things. One, that I listened to people, but then I investigated, demanded that they put their complaint in some form of an email or writing. Two, when they mentioned the election, I clearly rejected their overture to help my campaign somehow. Mm-hmm. And that's right there. You heard that. I heard that. And then what else did we hear? We heard that, you know, I actually didn't understand that even the agency they were talking about. I mentioned DHS, and yet they were talking about MDE. So it's not clear. It wasn't clear. It's apparent that in that conversation, it wasn't clear to me what agency they were even discussing. They didn't stop me and say, oh, no, 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 we're talking about another agency. You're talking about the commissioner and this agency. We're talking about this other agency. So it's not clear. So, you know, quite honestly, I think that the premise of your question is faulty, because at the end of the day, yes, my staff had been working on this for about a year. What I knew at that time is that my very competent staff was doing a good job representing MDE, that there was some dispute between a vendor and the agency, that I fully supported my staff member in that dispute, that dispute had gone in a direction we didn't want, but that my agency was continuing the fight and me as the Attorney General was backing up my staff member in supporting the agency. And then I went back to those people and said, what's going on? And it's clear to me that the right thing to do was to pursue that investigation and ultimate indictment and conviction, and to support the feds to do so. So I guess I don't agree that I did anything wrong other than to listen to people who ended up being liars.
Thank you. Did you have a quick follow-up? Otherwise, I have more people that want to.
I'm going to let others, because
okay,
we're running
Representative
out of time.
Rarick.
But
thank you, Madam Chair. So we don't have the a tape for this, but I have the transcript as you do, and it's public, and the entire 50-some minutes of this is public. It's been out there for a long time. But one of the things that I find repeatedly through the transcript is mentions of MDE. And the fraudsters literally go through step by step the how they do it, the who's involved. At the very beginning of the tape, they spell their names. They say Ikram Muhammad, and she spells Muhammad. They tell you who they are at the very first 2 minutes of the tape. It should be no surprise that they're talking about MDE, because it's almost on every page of my transcript, MDE, MDE, MDE. And they go through and talk about specifically the program that was being defrauded. And then you said, hey, tell me more about that. And they tell you in long explanation exactly how they basically perpetrated the fraud without saying they were fraudsters. So I would push back on your statement that you didn't know that they were talking about MDE, because if we had time to play the 50 minutes, we'd play the 50 minutes, but we don't have that kind of time. But it's throughout the entire tape and the transcript that's in front of me. The other thing I would say is that in your very own press release from your agency, from the Attorney General's office, dated September 26th of 2022, the very first line says, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison and his office have been deeply involved for 2 years, holding Feeding Our Future accountable. And yet you're saying a year later, so that would be an entire year before the tape, that you weren't aware of Feeding Our Future. And also I would say in the tape, it says multiple times Feeding Our Future. It talks about Safari Restaurant multiple times. In fact, there's one part in the tape that you said, oh, Safari Restaurant, I know you by your restaurant. That's what it says. That's what you said in the tape. So I would just push back on a lot of the things that you said, because if we had time to play the whole 50-some minutes, it would refute a lot of what you're saying. But, Madam Chair, I'll just leave it at that as a quick statement.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that?
Yes, you may, Attorney General.
Let me first of all discuss the September 2022 presser. Representative, my office sends out pressers all the time, and in those pressers they say Keith Ellison, the Attorney General's office, did thus and so. Just so you know, I obviously am not the primary lawyer on those files and know the details of that. Clearly, I'm the leader of the office. I'm ultimately responsible. I either ask the agency to, I ask my office to do a job. They know the mission. They pursue the mission. But that doesn't mean that I know exactly what's happening on every file any more than a police chief would know every ticket that was issued in a given year. It's just not possible to know. It's not the responsibility of the leader of the office to know every action on every file. So that, in my mind, clearly explains the verbiage used in that 2022 press release. It is what my office was doing. What my office is doing is what I'm doing. So I think that is pretty clear. Now, in addition to that, yeah, I mean, and up until that point, that day in December 2021, now, I did not know, nor would I know, the individual names that were going to be on a search warrant in a month after that meeting. There's a reason why they're called search warrants, and that is because they're searching for evidence to use in a criminal prosecution that had not been disclosed to me. The identities of the people who were doing it had not been disclosed to me. What was disclosed to me was that there was an ongoing dispute between vendors and the agency. I totally backed my agency. There's no one who, I don't believe there's anybody who's gonna say, oh, Ellison pulled us back or asked us not to get after these people. I said, yes, get after these people, absolutely. And then when the information became apparent, we cooperated in the prosecution. So, you know, I didn't know the names of the individuals. They were not disclosed to me. It's not necessary for the Attorney General to know the names of people who were under investigation.
Thank you. We take your point, Attorney General, but Lead Pinto also wants to still ask something. So quickly, Representative Rarick, your follow-up, and then Lead Pinto. Thank you.
Just really quickly. So you keep talking about the vendors. Wasn't Feeding Our Future the vendor? And they literally said that that's who they were.
You may quickly respond if you want. If otherwise, we'll go to Lead Pinto.
My colleague would like to comment.
Please remind us your name for the record.
My understanding is that they administered the sites to the vendors. I can't speak to the specific tape, what's being discussed on the tape, but they're not the actual sites themselves.
If I may, Madam Chair, just to answer the representative question.
Yes.
In December 2021, I mean, today everybody knows the name Feeding Our Future. At that time, they were not a household name. They simply weren't. And the last legal thing that happened is that a court made a finding adverse to my client. I didn't agree with it. We were fighting that. But I was backing my client, my staff to the hilt. But I also simultaneously was listening to constituents who happened to be lying. That's what you hear on that tape. I'm sorry.
Thank you. And just to correct the record from Ms. Washington, she said that Feeding Safari was not a site. They were actually one of the sites.
No, I'm sorry.
Not what she said.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I just mean to clarify my response to the
Representative.
Sorry to see Representative Radnick over there, that I believe she mentioned Feeding Our Future. She asked if Feeding Our Future was a site, and I was just responding to that.
Thank you. So just so everyone's clear, Safari Restaurant was a site.
Yes.
Just want to make sure that that's clear on the record. Okay. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I know we've got really limited time, so maybe just a couple of comments probably. First, regarding the awareness, sort of what was going on at that time in this recording, as I look at the transcript, maybe I'll even direct folks' attention. This is the AI-generated transcript on page 5. One of the many errors in here is that a question that the Attorney General asked is actually attributed to one of the participants, where the participant talks about the Child and Adult Care Food Program, Department of Education, and the Attorney General interrupts him and says, wait a minute, what is that? And he's clearly very confused about what he just doesn't know, because he's overseeing an office of 400 lawyers. In the middle of it, he texts his attorney who's overseeing that area to just ask some basic questions. I did listen to the whole hour and reviewed everything, and I noticed that, in fact, the only name of a commissioner he says is the commissioner of the DHS, not commissioner of MDE. Like, it's like he's overseeing all sorts of things. I will say that at the time, I was certainly aware of concerns by many people in the community. My own jurisdiction was in the DHS space, and so a lot of concerns with DHS. I'm sure the Attorney General, I suspect, was hearing in other meetings as well concerns. That doesn't mean they're all well-founded, right? These ones were particularly badly founded because it turned out they were fraudsters. But you're hearing from other people who are earnest and concerned, and so trying to sort of sort things through and provide that attention. I'm just thinking about my own role in the county attorney's office in Ramsey. I put together a sex trafficking case, ended up resulting in the longest sentence in state history. For like the 9 months I built that case, John Choi didn't know what I was working on, right? Only right at the very end did he find out what ended up being this major case for us. So I'll just say, I think the transcript and just logic would say the Attorney General has a lot going on in the course of things. And I appreciate that it certainly, it sounds like, and it's consistent that right after the meeting, he looked into things and found out, oh my goodness, what is going on, and wants to make sure that then pursuing things. And then I'll note also in the transcript that what he ends with, the action step he's walking out with, is asking questions. What's going on? He says he's going to ask Commissioner Harpstead from DHS, because again, that's where his head is. But he's going to ask questions, which is thank goodness that he's doing that. And then final point is just thinking about the timeline here. MDE actually noticed a concern and starts going after what turned out to be fraudsters. It's tough to know at the time they're fraudsters. MDE knows there's concern. They start trying to cut off payments. The Attorney General, his staff is representing them, and the district court sanctions MDE and then says, and it's true, does not say you have to resume payments, but says there'll be a, quote, big problem if you don't. And we kind of know how to read when courts say that sort of thing. And then later on, there's the meeting, et cetera. So I just think we can be very proud of the actions of MDE, proud of the actions of our Attorney General in this incident. On the other hand, we've been talking a long time about a recording from 3.5 years ago. I'm grateful to you, Attorney General, for everything else you've talked about at the beginning of this presentation, about all the work that you're doing to go after fraudsters, not only about public funds in terms of charities, and to protect consumers from business and corporate fraud as well. That's all incredibly important work. I'm grateful to you for it and for clearing up some of I hope that folks now have had their questions answered and confusion cleared up by this recording from several years ago. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Attorney General, any response?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Pinto. I think I cannot improve on the statement that you just made. I think it's accurate. I just want to be clear. If I am willing to work 100% with everyone on this committee and the entire legislature on fighting fraud, I'm in the fight with you. Let's do it. One thing that's cleared, however, is that when offered help in my campaign, I rejected it on the tape. You can hear it. I didn't know I was being recorded. That happened. And you will not find anybody in this world to say, oh, Ellison tried to back us up off of our investigation. Nobody will say, I tried to pull my team off the investigation. I did nothing for these people. I did nothing. I accepted nothing from these people, and they were convicted, and my office played a role. No, I don't know everything about every file that comes through the door, but I have a great team that does. I back them 100%, and I think they did a valiant job. So, Representative Pinto, thank you for pointing those things out. I hope that we can work together to fight fraud, waste, fraud, and abuse. I'm not naive. I know that we live in a political world, but if we can leave politics aside and try to figure out how to protect the public dollar, you have a partner in me.
Thank you for that, Mr. Attorney General. And I appreciate your closing statement. I appreciate that you came to the committee today. We do appreciate the work of your office, and we do look forward to having the Medicaid Fraud Unit here at a future meeting. Your last statement, I have to say, just raised a question with me. So I'm going to quickly allow myself a quick follow-up. So in the tape, it said you asked them to send you an email outlining who was being sort of harassed, and that you would follow up with, in the tape, it says MDE and Jody Harpstead. Did you ever get that email?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, I don't have any memory, as I sit here, of receiving any such email. I'll check my records.
Thank
but
you.
I don't remember ever receiving any such follow-up document. And if they didn't send it, I certainly didn't remind them to. But I'll check, but I don't think so.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then did you have any follow-up conversation with Commissioner Harpstead or the Commissioner of MDE in response to this meeting where you said, we'll fight them, I'll call them? Did those follow-up conversations happen?
No, okay. Because when I got back to the office and said, what's going on with this, it became clear that this was a suspected fraud matter, not just a routine dispute between a vendor and a agency, or the but was something of a very different nature. So right there, I just said, "Oh, okay," and no, I didn't reach out to anybody.
Okay, and you've repeatedly said you didn't do anything for them or take anything from them. Did you receive any donations from them?
Not from anyone in that meeting.
Okay.
There were people who sent me donations that were ancillarily, if that's a word, connected to this. I sent the ones I'm aware of elsewhere. I actually sent a check back to a lawyer connected to this. Once it became clear they were in some way a part of this, I said, we can't accept your money. I sent it back. If it becomes aware, if it becomes clear to me that happened, our way of handling these is to find an appropriate way to send that money away. But for the people who were in that meeting, the answer is no.
Okay. And did you send the money back for people affiliated with Feeding Our Future that you did receive? All of it was returned?
Well, again, at this point, unless they were indicted or convicted, we may or may not know how closely or they were associated. So what I want to tell you is that nobody in that meeting sent us campaign donations, to my knowledge, and I have asked, okay? I don't know the names of those people, but I have asked, and I've been told no. Nobody in that meeting donated to you. But there was a, I know one lawyer who was representing somebody connected to this situation, and I know that we sent that money back because that particular donor called me up angry about us sending their check back. So right. I know of that. I know about that one. If we have others that, you know, we'll certainly deal Perfect. With them in the proper
but if,
way.
If you could just follow up with me on this, defendant number 36 and defendant number 69 did max out to you, and I don't see any record of those being returned. So if you could look into that, I would appreciate it.
We certainly would do that if we can keep. Let me just make notes of that. You say defendant
36. Yeah, defendant 36 and defendant 69.
36, 69. Yeah, Madam Chair, we certainly will follow up with that. And
same with the email if you ever receive the email. Perfect.
But I would say, Madam Chair, I do not believe that defendant 36 and 69 were in that particular meeting.
Right. I don't believe they were in the meeting either. I just, because they're ancillarily tied to the investigation your office was involved in, I just would like to see what anything was done with that contribution. And I look forward also to a separate meeting with Ms. Washington about some of the charities things that I'd like to follow up on. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair, may I just say in closing, I appreciate you all having me here. I hope some of the things that members were concerned about, I've tried to answer in the most fulsome, honest, straightforward way that I could. That's why I did an op-ed. That's why I'm here today. And I also want to just let you know that, it is important to me that we work together to stop waste, fraud, and abuse for a few reasons. One is because it's wrong, and number two, because I fear that it erodes the support for important programming, which I care about. I care about Medicaid. I want people to get it, and if there's people believe it's a fraudulent program, I fear people won't support the program. And the same way with these emergency food programs. At the end of the day, I would just say this to members. Whenever there's a crisis, we also have got to put on our detective hat because fraudsters try to make use of those tragic incidents to enrich themselves.
We agree, and we look forward to working with you, Attorney General. We are adjourned. Thank you.